the runner-up's ticket to the playoffs, but perhaps the most unlikely aspirant to that distinction is the Florida Marlins. Earlier this summer, they were 20 games under 500. The Marlins' payroll is about $11.08. Over the last few years, the club's roster has experienced more turnover than a fast food franchise, and yet, with a hot streak, Florida could make the postseason. Joining me on the line now to discuss the potentially marvelous Florida Marlins is national sports columnist for Gannett News Service, Mike Lopresti. Mike, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you.
The Marlins and Phillies, both vying for the National League wild card, began a four-game series on Thursday. The Phillies took the first two games in Florida. Will young and inexperienced Marlins bounce back?
Well, they have all year. I mean, bouncing back is one of the things that made it such a great story. You're talking about a team, as you mentioned, 20 games under 500. And if history means anything, once a team reaches that level, they're pretty much forgotten. But here they are in contention. Now, they've been helped by the fact that it's a rather forgiving season in the National League, where a 500 record stamps you as a contender. But I saw them play early in the season, and a Major League Baseball team was a kind characterization at that point. But they have bounced back, and they may have to again.
Tell me about the players who've made the biggest and perhaps most surprising contributions to the Marlins in 2006.
Well, if you say the Marlins to most people, and that might include a lot of fans in South Florida, Dontrelle Willis is where it begins and where it ends. You're looking at a team that has used 21 rookies. The Marlins are led by rookies. You're talking about a guy like a second baseman like Dan Uggla. Who knew him? But he's a guy who has a chance to lead the National League in a lot of rookie categories. He's combined with Josh Willingham. They both hit more than 20 home runs this season. And you have to go back many, many decades to find a National League team where two rookies hit more than 20 home runs. They just got a lot of young guys do well. And then, obviously, the biggest example of that, the most recent, was Anibal Sanchez throwing a no-hitter the other night. You know, we've not seen a no-hitter in Major League Baseball for more than 2 years since Randy Johnson. I think probably the longest stretch without a no-hitter in something like 50 or 60 years, and it took a Florida Marlins rookie to end the streak, which sort of fits the motif of the year for the Marlins.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about Anibal Sanchez. He has a 2.89 ERA this season. The Marlins obtained him and two other prospects from the Red Sox for Josh Beckett, who has an ERA of something over 5, good enough for a 3-year, $30 million extension that he signed this summer. Is it too soon for the Marlins to tab Sanchez as a $20 million a year guy?
Probably not Sanchez's agent. It's not too early, but the world is full of players who played well their first 4 months in the major leagues, and then things began to go wrong, particularly pitchers, which trouble can be a sore arm away. So too early to stamp any of these guys as stars, but certainly they have had a lot of good young players who, in their first taste of Major League Baseball, have done very well, and certainly throwing a no-hitter at this stage of his career is a pretty good start. But I think we're a little ways away from being the Yankees.
When you talk about young players, it's an understatement. The Marlins jettisoned several players from the 2005 roster, trimmed the payroll from $75 million to a shade under $15 million, and now they pay most of their players the league minimum, which is $327,000, yet they have managed to find themselves in a race for the wild card with just 3 weeks to go in the season. Has any major league team ever done that before?
No, I think what comes to mind in recent times are two teams, the Minnesota Twins and then the Oakland A's. But we have never seen a team that is so far behind. You're talking about a team that not only is 1/15th or 20th of the Yankee payroll, but you would have to double the Marlins payroll to get close to the next lowest paid team in the major leagues, and that would be the Tampa Bay Devil Rays. You'd have to triple them to get the Kansas City Royals, who have the worst record in baseball. So we have seen some teams do well, contrary to what their payroll would suggest, but we have never seen a team so far in the basement as far as payroll stand here in early September and have a realistic shot at making the playoffs. It's just astounding.
Well, should the big money, big market teams, the Red Sox, the Yankees, the Dodgers, et cetera, view this as a total fluke or as a cautionary tale?
Well, it's interesting you bring up that question because I discussed that with a couple of the Marlins players last week, and they said, you know, we have been very fortunate. I mean, a lot of young players have had pretty good years. And again, I think you can't underestimate this. The National League has not exactly been a murderer's row of contenders this season. So we're looking at where a 500 record puts you right in the hunt. So I don't think the general managers and owners of baseball are thinking, boy, $15 million is the way to go. But I think it's more of a short-term sensation than a long-term program they have there.
What are the fans who were disenchanted by the off-season weirdness, and there were apparently a lot of those fans, saying now?
Well, if you could find them, it'd be interesting to see. I mean, another of the amazing statistics that people often talk about the Marlins are the number of empty seats that are there each and every game, and maybe you expected that early in the year. It's slightly amazing this week with the notoriety and the excitement that has begun to build, at least in the media, about the Marlins, and you have a young, exciting team and overachieving and beating the odds and Cinderella and on and on and on, to see them return home and play a series against the Phillies and find 12,000 people in the stands. One of my columns this week is saying, you know, if you don't have a team in the wild card race, if you are not a Twins fan, if you are not a Phillies fan, how could you not jump on this bandwagon? I've heard a lot of baseball fans say for years, you know, we're tired of people making big money. We're tired of all these old veterans who don't play hard. And here's the young guys who don't get paid very much, and they're trying to get to the playoffs. I mean, how could you not love this team if you didn't have a real heartfelt affiliation with a contending team?
I wonder if there would be a sort of poetic justice in a World Series that once again featured the Yankees and the Marlins. I mean, the team with a payroll of $11.
First of all, you would have to bring in, you know, statisticians, mathematicians, actuary people to try to break down what the payrolls look like. You know, all sort of comparisons between the two. It would be an incredible morality play as far as from the financial standpoint. Now, that said, I don't think that's going to happen. Actually, I think probably we begin to see one team poke its nose above the crowd in the National League wild card race, and I think that might be the Padres. But that said, just to see the Marlins in the playoffs would be fantastic. To see them in a World Series against the Yankees, a team who have three or four players who by themselves will make more money this year than the entire Marlins team, would be just an incredible sight. And maybe people in Florida would actually go watch that game.
Mike Lopresti is a sports columnist for Gannett News Service. He spoke to me from Indianapolis. Mike, thank you very much for joining me.
Sure thing.
The sirens outside of Fenway Park in Boston on Tuesday night were not wailing for the visiting team, though some of the more pessimistic members of the Chicago White Sox might have thought otherwise, given the ongoing emergency they seem to be experiencing. Last year, the White Sox finished on top of the American League Central Division, then charged through the playoffs, presenting Chicago with its first World Series winner since 1917. This time around, the Detroit Tigers jumped to a big lead in the Central Division, and they have held on through a late summer slump, and the Minnesota Twins have been battling Chicago in the race for the American League's wild card. Mike Bauman, who's been covering the White Sox for MajorLeagueBaseball.com, says explaining why Chicago hasn't been repeating last season's success is as easy as 4-7-4.
These starting pitchers have an earned run average about a run higher than last year. It was 3-7-5 last season, and going into last night it was 4-7-4 this season. And that explains almost everything. But that's been the issue. Last year the starting pitching carried them not only in the regular season, but in the postseason. You know, they won 11 of 12 games, largely on the strength of astoundingly good starting pitching. That hasn't been as consistent this year.
Baseball can be spectacularly perverse, so on Monday and Tuesday nights, the White Sox enjoyed outstanding starting pitching and lost two games, 3-2 and 1-0. One of the runs in the earlier loss came on the season's 38th homer by Jim Thome, the veteran who came to Chicago from the Philadelphia Phillies in November and has been among the American League's home run leaders this season. In the dugout before Tuesday night's game, Thome acknowledged he's been frustrated at his club's inability to make up ground on the Tigers and the Twins, even as those teams have struggled.
Well, you know, but it hasn't happened. You know, there's no sense of dwelling on that and looking to yesterday. You got to worry about today. Sometimes it just, you know, you go through periods where you'll play well for five games and then, you know, you'll hit a streak where you don't. And that's part of the game. If you look in baseball, that's happening around a lot of teams.
It's been happening to the White Sox in part because Thome himself has been sidelined on and off with a hamstring injury. I asked him whether the fear that the Sox are running out of time this season was pressuring him to forget the injuries and get back on the field.
They're there. You know, they are what they are. And, you know, I've just come to learn that, you know what, in September, no matter how long you play, you're going to play with some nagging injuries. Unfortunately, this hamstring has been a little more nagging than just a nagging injury. You know, I hurt it in Detroit and then tried to come back, tweaked it, and couldn't run. So, you know, that makes it tougher. But, you know, we're going out there, and, you know, it's what it's all about.
So I'm thinking you're in the World Series. It's Kirk Gibson Redux. Can barely make it around the bases, but you win it anyway.
Well, we'll be out there. We'll be out there for sure.
Rare words, brave world. But that the defending champions will be out there with the opportunity to repeat is no certainty. Detroit's recent sluggishness notwithstanding, the Tigers don't seem likely to slip from the top of the division. And when the White Sox meet the Twins for the final three games of the season, perhaps with the wild card on the line, those games will be in Minnesota. It'll be a grind for Chicago to earn the opportunity to play in October. I asked MLB.com's Mike Bauman if he thought maybe relief at finally winning a World Series last fall had made the current White Sox a little less hungry for another pennant.
That's a good question. I think not. I mean, we all, as humans, would look at that. But I think that they enjoyed last year so much and it gave them so much confidence that they really came into the season believing they would build on this. And they've been sort of dismayed that it hasn't occurred that way. But no, I don't think that complacency or smugness has set in.
For the past several days, White Sox manager Ozzie Guillen has been telling his players, reporters, and anybody else who will listen that nobody cares what the White Sox were doing from April through August. All that matters is what they do in the remaining score of games between now and October 1st. If Chicago can string together enough wins to slip past Minnesota and make the playoffs, he'll be proven right. If not, Sox fans will have most of the fall and all of the winter to wonder how the team that won it all last season managed to let the Tigers and the Twins squeeze past them and stay there. It's 19 minutes past the hour. Life may be about to embrace as well as imitate art in Philadelphia. A statue of fictional boxer Rocky Balboa may be moved to the steps of the Philadelphia Art Museum, a non-fictional building, the steps of which the fictional boxer triumphantly climbed in a pretend story in a real film. The statue was donated to the actual art museum in the real and present Philadelphia by Sylvester University of California to Alabama to play the all-white team coached by Bear Bryant. USC won that game 42-21, largely on the strength of running back Sam Cunningham's performance. Don Yeager wrote the book with the assistance of Sam Cunningham and John Papadakis, another USC player. Don Yeager and Sam Cunningham join me now from NPR's New York Bureau. Gentlemen, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks.
Don, why was that game in 1970 such a big deal?
You know, I, in your intro there, you talked about it being a stretch that it to question whether a game might actually be a catalyst for social change. As you noted there, I make the point in the book that it's not a stretch. And in fact, we opened the book with a scene in 2003 when USC returned to play in Alabama against Auburn, in the opening game of the season. And the head coach at USC was starting a quarterback that had never thrown a pass in college football named Matt Leinart, a running back who had never carried the ball in college football named Reggie Bush. He was a little bit overwhelmed by the moment, so he was trying to look for some edge, something he could do. And he brought along with him two gentlemen, Sam Cunningham and John Papadakis, who had played in that 1970 game, to kind of give his team some perspective. That wasn't just all that happened. That night, the night before the game, Sam and John actually went to a very famous restaurant in Montgomery, and when the waiter found out that the man he was serving, ironically sitting below a picture of Governor George Wallace, the great segregationist, when he realized the man he was serving was Sam Cunningham, Sam Bam Cunningham, the man who had made that game so famous in 1970, he got almost tearful, and one by one he went into the kitchen, and one by one every African American employee of their restaurant came out to thank Sam about how that game and tell him how that game had shaped the way African Americans were viewed in Alabama. Forget football. Forget the fact that the next year Bear Bryant had his first African American players on his team. This game meant something to waiters and waitresses and busboys and cooks in a restaurant in Montgomery, Alabama. That tells you the game was bigger than just what happened on the field that night.
And, Sam, I assume you never had to take your wallet out of your pocket that night.
No, I think this trip was all paid for in more ways than one. And I think I was there to help Coach Carroll, but it was an education and an amazing opportunity for me to understand what happened 30-something-odd years ago and hear it from the people's mouths themselves.
Don, as you've explained, the Alabama team that played USC that day had no black players, but Bryant had already recruited a black man who was a freshman. Freshmen couldn't play on the varsity at that time. Wouldn't he have played on the varsity the following year, even if Alabama had never played USC?
No question. Yeah, I mean, Wilbur Jackson sat in the stands that night. He was Bear Bryant's Alabama's first African-American football recruit. And he sat in the stands, watched the game. It was a fascinating interview with him because he talked about being somewhat torn, though he clearly was an Alabama guy and wanted Alabama to win. You know, the fact that African Americans were making their first serious play in front of Alabama fans was valuable to him. I don't think there's any, as you pointed out, that any question that they would have had an African American on the team the next year. It just became easier because fans were able to see not just that African Americans could contribute to the greater game of football, but that they did so in Sam's case with such not just force but class. Mm. And I think that that broke down a lot of barriers for an awful lot of people that were sitting there in the stands that might have had another opinion prior to that game.
Don, you write that Bear Bryant knew that, quote, if Alabama's all-white team won the game, then he would likely face stronger opposition to integrating the Crimson Tide, the Alabama team. Did Bryant plan on losing the game?
I never met Bear Bryant. I'll admit that. But I will tell you that everything I know and everyone I know that was close to him would tell you that he was not a man that ever would have planned to lose. But you know, let's be honest, he was coming off of a 6-5 season, not a very good team, and suddenly when he has an opportunity to schedule an extra game, he goes out and picks a team that had gone to 4 straight Rose Bowls, a team, you know, in USC that was not just talented but returning most of that talent. And I think that anybody who understands football knows that he probably knew the odds were stacked against him, and that may be the perfect kind of game for him to make this kind of statement in. I don't think he actually said, you know what, we're going to go out and tank this. But, you know, given the talent level that USC had, they didn't have to tank it. USC was just that much better.
Sam, there has long circulated a story that says that after that game, Bear Bryant brought you into the Alabama locker room, came in and asked Coach McKay for permission to borrow you for a minute, brought you into the Alabama locker room, stood you up in front of his team and said, here's what a football player looks like. Now, that scene is rather cloudy in the book. I mean, some people seem to remember parts of it. Some people say it never happened. What about it?
Well, I guess if I was, you know, on the Alabama team, I'd say it never happened. And I don't actually remember it happening, but I do remember talking with Coach Bryant after the game, which is rare because I think every other game after that I've ever played, you know, the head coach of the opposing team never had 25 cents to say, you know, to me or any of my teammates, you know. But, you know, stories grow. I mean, like, as a kid, you know, I was told stories about the boogeyman, but I've never seen him.
Now that's an interesting comparison.
I'm still waiting, and I'm sure he's there somewhere, but I just haven't seen him. So,
I think that's part of what made this book and this project so awesome is that they're really, it's not just an important game, but it's a game that some of the stories took on lives of their own. That story, yes, I mean, I heard it. Over and over. I heard it from Alabama fans. I heard people from Alabama say that it happened. Yeah. I mean, there's no question Bear Bryant came into the USC locker room afterward, congratulated Sam, congratulated Clarence Davis, and to Clarence said things like, you know, I hope we never let a young man as talented as you leave the state of Alabama again. But the dramatic, you know, standing on a stool and each Alabama player having to shake Sam's hand, which is, you know, another one of the rumors I've heard. I don't believe they happened, but I do think that, again, part of what makes this book and project so fantastic is that, you know, it wasn't just an event. It became mythological in many ways.
Sam, in Turning of the Tide, a number of people in Alabama and elsewhere are quoted as saying that you did more for the cause of integration than Martin Luther King did. How did that make you feel?
Well, that was by no means my motivation of playing as well as I played. You know, as I try to talk to mentor young kids, I tell them, I say, you know, go out and play and do whatever you have to do to the best of your ability, because you never know what's going to happen. I mean, did I know I was going to gain 100 yards that evening, score touchdowns? No, I didn't even have a true idea that I would play that much, because I was not the starting fullback. I was a backup. I get in, I get a chance, and I take advantage of that. I do exactly as I'm supposed to do, because if I don't, I don't get a chance to play the following week.
I will tell you that over the course of working on this book, I've spent many hours with Sam. There's really only one question I've ever posed to him, and you just posed it as well, in which I watch him squirm. I think I think he feels a little odd about that, and you know, every time it comes up, it's a tough place to be for him. And I don't want to speak for him, but I watch him dance around it better than he did on any linebacker in his NFL career.
Well, I squirm because when that is said, I get placed next to Martin Luther King and people who have died and done things. That was what they chose to do. I just play football, and in playing it as well as I did that evening, I get lined up with people that I respect and people that have done, in my mind, a lot more for civil rights and equality than I could ever possibly do in a lifetime of whatever I've done. So that's the only reason that I squirm and dance and feel unsure. But I mean, we as a team, and I tell people this all the time. Yeah, I get credit for a lot that happened that evening, but we as a team did what we did. You know, I didn't get on the plane and fly by myself. I didn't go dress and play by myself. You know, I had teammates, and you know, they were white, black, and brown, and we went out and did what we were supposed to do, and that was win a football game. And from doing that, history was made, and we effected a change that is felt today. This is 36 years after it ever happened. Here we are sitting up here talking about it and enjoying talking about it.
Don Yeager is the author of Turning of the Tide, How One Game Changed the South, published by Center Street Press. Don Yeager and Sam Cunningham join me from NPR's New York Bureau. Gentlemen, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you.
And thank you for having us.
This weekend, a couple dozen paddlers are in Ohio for the National Interpretive Freestyle Canoeing Championships. Picture figure skating or synchronized swimming in a canoe, replete with dance-like flourishes, evocative music, and sometimes even costumes. Defending his title is the youngest canoeist to win top honors in the sport's 20-year history, 10th grader Jonathan Hammond from Northern New York State. North Country Public Radio's David Summerstein has a profile.
It's a glistening summer day on Star Lake in New York's Adirondack Mountains. A dozen canoeists dot the water. 14-year-old Jonathan Hammond's kneeling in a solo canoe, experimenting.
I actually took all the seats and the thwarts out of this just to try it and see what it'd be like, but I think I'm going to put the seat back in because you can brace against it.
Jonathan has the swarthy look of a boy who spends his summers on the water. Muscular, bronze skin, with sun-bleached blonde hair and deep blue eyes. He could pass for a teen surfer or skateboarder, but he's the reigning champion of interpretive freestyle canoeing, a tiny and obscure sport that's not exactly the rage amongst teenagers. He shows me a move called a wedge. Jonathan leans into a turn. The canoe tilts perilously to the water, the gunwale an inch from the surface. His paddle's pointed outward, as if it were a cane keeping him upright. But of course, it's not. Only body strength keeps him from swamping.
This is my least favorite because there's no brace. The paddle is pointed towards the boat, so it'll turn me away from the direction I'm leaning.
Jonathan grew up on the St. Lawrence River, so he's no stranger to water sports. But his grandmother introduced him to this one just 5 years ago.
She thought it was really cool. So the next year she brought me because she thought I'd like it, and I've been doing it ever since.
Donna Hammond is athletic and blonde, like her grandson. She's a retired art teacher with a dance background.
My idea of paddling used to be to sit in the front of the canoe and tell my husband which way to go.
Then she saw an interpretive canoeing exhibition, and she was hooked.
Water, music, and dance. When I saw that all put together, it was something almost spiritual, and I just fell in love with it.
The sport combines the grace of ballet with the moves of whitewater paddling. It was developed in the Adirondacks in the 1980s as a way to master balance and control in a canoe. But it's since evolved into a more creative discipline. Performances are informal. Competitors judge each other. Meets feel more like a family picnic than a national championship. The canoes are top-notch, though, lightweight, with warm cedar or cherry ribbing. Women's champion Elaine Mravitz runs through her routine in preparation for this weekend's competition. As she paddles, her arms and torso swoop and arc, as a figure skater's would. It's so effortless, she looks like she's half woman, half canoe. A former phys ed teacher and dancer, she confesses she's a ham.
Those of us crazy people that like working with music and maybe have a little bit of dance background or music background, or those that don't and just like doing that sort of thing, can form a pretty audience-pleasing routine that we hope they enjoy.
One crowd pleaser is a move called the Hiding Herald. Mravitz demonstrates.
I'm going to do a nice hard J, and I'm going to lean down over the gunwale, and my paddle's going to come under the water.
Mravitz leans shoulder deep into the lake. The canoe's almost perpendicular to the water, hiding her body. With her paddle entirely submerged, Mravitz stirs the water and does a 360.
Wow.
There you go.
That was wild. So you went and sort of did a circle, angled almost, you were almost tipped over.
Down the beach, Jonathan Hammond warms up for his routine. He makes a spin look easy. He says it wasn't that way his first performance.
That was really kind of shaky. When I went out there, and I dumped on, I flipped over on a move that one of the instructors and I had been working on all day. It was the wedge. And after that, though, it was really smooth, and it felt great.
So great that it only took 2 years of competition before Hammond defeated 50-something Mark Ornstein in last summer's championships. Now Jonathan's success is attracting younger people to the sport.
Come in when you're ready, Jonathan.
Jonathan's doing his routine this year to a version of Styx's Come Sail Away, performed by his father Dan. More rockin' than the operatic numbers, but hardly the Zeppelin or Nickelback other kids his age listen to.
The music that we use is mellower than like the punk rock or whatever. You kind of escape from the busyness of everything else.
In classic teenage fashion, Jonathan downplays the whole thing. He describes the sport to his friends as fancy paddling with music. And while other kids play soccer or football or video games, he likes doing his own thing.
I don't know, it's a dual personality kind of thing. Part of me is kind of like everybody else, and part of me is, it's a little different. I like being different.
Donna Hammond will also compete this weekend. She and Jonathan do lots of what she calls grandma and me activities. But the sport they share is special, and they may have begun the first dynasty in interpretive freestyle canoeing. Donna says there's a dimension to all this she may appreciate even more than her grandson.
This is building memories that he will have with him the rest of his life that I can give to him, that we can share. When I can't remember them anymore, maybe he can remind me of what it's like.
Jonathan and Donna Hammond are competing this weekend in the National Interpretive Freestyle Canoeing Championships in Peninsula, Ohio. For Only a Game, I'm David Summerstein in Star Lake, New York.
I look to the sea. Reflections on the waves spark my memory. Some happy, some sad.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where Only a Game is produced. Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information available at bicon.com, BICON.com. And the dairy farm families who own Cabot Creamery, five generations of farming and making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont, on the web at CabotCheese.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
I'm Scott Simon. Bunting bedecked ball yards befit Bill Littlefield. But Only a Game is not National Public Radio's only national pastime postseason presence. For all the fall classic fun, fanaticism, folderol, and news from around the world, tune into Weekend Edition Saturday from NPR News.
So does that explain how the Shock came back to force Game 5?
Well, the Shock played very, very well, and Bill Laimbeer is proving to be just as big a jackass as a coach as he ever was as a player. He's ripping television commentator. He's ripping the official. He's doing the us versus the world thing that the Pistons used to use, and he's taking all the joy out of it the way he used to take all the joy out of everything as soon as he stepped on the floor. But I do like his team, and I like their chances. And moving to Joe Louis, where the octopi will fly.
Exactly. The U.S. Anti-Doping Agency announced this week that although Marion Jones had tested positive for EPO on June 23rd, the B sample of that specimen was negative, and so Jones is not banned from competition. Does this result back up the critics who've been saying USADA's tests are hopelessly flawed?
It's hard to know. I mean, because I'm not biochemist enough to know what exactly the tests are. But it is a real strike against the whole notion of testing people, and somehow the original positive sample always finds its way into the media somehow, and now you've got a B sample. Now you really look stupid. Marion Jones can now compete for as long as she wants, and now you've got some sort of existential decision to make as to whether or not you believe the test you always demanded she take. Anybody who thinks it's a simple matter of more testing and better testing can look to this episode and, I think, take a little pause.
Scandal at the U.S. Open this week, Charlie, and it involves Maria Sharapova, who defeated Amelie Mauresmo in yesterday's semis, and it also involves a banana, and I hasten to add the story is perfectly appropriate for listeners of all ages.
And not only that, Bill, I am happy to see you. Maria Sharapova's father, whose name is Yuri, and what an upset that is, by the way.
Shock.
Apparently, he signaled her, allegedly, by pulling out a banana and eating it, and then the signal was, please eat something, you're not playing well. So shortly after Yuri brought out the banana and ate it, Maria brought out a piece of fruit and ate that, and there's some kerfuffling going on about whether or not she had been coached to eat the fruit. By the way, shall I eat a peach?
If I had a banana, I'd pull it out and signal you. On the men's side, the two men you watched battle it out last week, unless it was last year, are out of the U.S. Open. Do you wish James Blake and
Best
Andre
match
Agassi,
I saw all year.
Do you wish that they had fared better this time around?
I wish James Blake had been able to run into Roger Federer later in the tournament, because without Rafael Nadal, who's already gone, this is really sort of a coronation slash photo op for Roger Federer, unless one of the planes landing at LaGuardia lands at midcourt instead and lands on his head. Agassi simply wasn't physically capable of going through the U.S. Open anymore. He had a great send-off. A very beloved figure, and those of us who covered him when he was a young and kind of obstreperous and not very pleasant to be around guy and referred to him as Andre the Client are now amazed at the kind of wonderful guy he's grown into.
Last Saturday, two Kansas football fans were told that they would need to purchase a $35 ticket for their three-month-old daughter, in addition to the tickets they already had, in order to attend the Jayhawks season opener. Are you surprised at the reason offered by Kansas Associate Athletic Director Jim Marchione for this?
All right. Full disclaimer, Jim Marchione is one of my oldest friends in college sports and a great guy. It's really too bad that you have to buy a ticket for your baby. There are apparently two reasons. Number one, as you and I both know being parents, traveling with a baby means you travel with a small army full of stuff. So basically what he's arguing is that even if you don't need the chair for the baby, you need the chair for the stuff. And number two, somehow the Department of Homeland Security has gotten involved with this, and he claims that they need to somehow have a better handle on the numbers at a game. I find that one a little dubious. Although, I mean, as dubious as you may be about the Department of Homeland Security, I kind of find it funny that they might be concerned with people smuggling in explosive infants.
The National Football League season opened with a traditional Thursday night game during which Pittsburgh defeated Miami. Assuming our listeners don't all have the cable packages which will allow them to simultaneously view all 13 of tomorrow's games, which ones should they watch?
The first interesting thing was the Miami, who was thought of as being a really possible contender and a challenge to the New England Patriots in the Eastern Division of the AFC, looked really bad. Their quarterback, Dante Culpepper, looked really terrible when it counted. They lost to Pittsburgh. That's already a pretty big loss. I like Michael Vick against the Carolina Panthers. I like Carson Palmer playing at Kansas City in his first game back from the knee injury. And on Sunday night, you have the Battle of the Manning Brothers in the Meadowlands, which is always intriguing.
The average price of a ticket to a National Football League game went up 5.6% to $62.38 this season. Charlie, does that mean the games will be 5.6% more interesting?
No, but it does mean that your baby is going to cost 5.6 more to go to the game.
Since we last spoke, Spain beat Greece to establish themselves as best at basketball. The U.S. finished third in the World Championships, and Kobe Bryant has announced that he knows why. Maybe coaching is in his blood.
Kobe's problem was he wasn't there, basically, and he's decided that the chemistry wasn't there, although all we heard of through the entire run-up and through the World Championship is how well everybody there got along. Kobe, as you know, is always a great unifying factor in any team he's on, so I think he's basically pitching for a chance to go to Beijing.
In NBA news, can you stand the excitement of the Magic returning to the Golden State Warriors?
Oh, God, who cares? I am so tired of Don Nelson. The Golden State Warriors have now assured themselves of going out in the second round of the playoffs for the foreseeable future. Welcome back, Don. I really don't care.
Softball is about to get kicked out of the Olympics, as you know, Charlie, but the World Championships in China gave the U.S. a player to admire before the sport is banished entirely to oblivion. How do you like the achievement of Cat Osterman on the tournament's final day?
Well, we've got to go back to the days of Iron Mike McGinnity and stuff. She threw back-to-back seven-inning games, wound up 6-0, and the United States has won its sixth World Championship.
Charlie, a lot of people left when the Major League Soccer team in Utah decided to call themselves Real Salt Lake.
I'm still laughing about it.
But based on the partnership the team announced this week, maybe the Utah club got the last laugh.
They signed a 10-year agreement with the real Real, the authentically real Real Madrid, which they're going to, you know, players are going to train together and they're going to play each other every year. And I guess we can say that Dave Checketts and the rest of the people in Utah are keeping it Real.
And finally, O knowledgeable one, talk to me of vodka-soaked compresses.
Yeah, the world champion and world record holder in the 400-meter hurdles, Yulia Penchenkina, has ruined her season because she was using vodka-soaked compresses and she burned her skin. Now, I'm not exactly sure how this works, but all I know is I would be lying if I was a Russian athlete and saying I had migraines.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. His new book, Moving the Chains, Tom Brady and the Pursuit of Everything, will be out next month. He joins me each week at this time. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Tiger Woods earned about $11 million last year from his exploits on the golf course, and he was able to pick up a little pin money here and there, about $75 million worth, as an endorser of everything from overpriced athletic shoes to overpriced American gas guzzlers. But as Only a Game's Michelle Seaton reports, it may not be too long before Tiger is looking over his shoulder at a new group of athletes adept at shooting a little ball with great accuracy, and who already have begun to cash in the big endorsement bucks.
Oliver Lang has one complaint about the sport of paintball.
Every time someone asks me what I do, I say professional paintball, and they say, oh, so are you, you know, were you in the military? Are you involved in the war? Or, you know, have they ever recruited you? And it's not like that at all.
Lang, who just turned 24, is the most famous pro paintball player in the world, the highest paid, too. Dye Precision Paintball, a manufacturer of air guns and protective gear, pays Lang $100,000 a year to promote its products and the sport. Outsiders just don't get it, says Lang, who is carrying a mock AK-47 air gun that can shoot a paint-filled bath bead at roughly 300 feet per second. In a few minutes, Lang joins the rest of the Dye Precision team, called the LA Ironmen, and enters the temporary arena erected in the parking lot outside Gillette Stadium in Foxborough, Massachusetts. Here, he will crawl around on the AstroTurf and duck behind plastic inflatable bunkers in an effort to shoot one or all of the seven guys on the opposite team. Paintballs exploding everywhere, everyone screaming instructions. What's not to love? This is the best promotion for the sport, playing it in front of temporary grandstands filled with young, hopeful players such as Nick Collier and Paul Doyle, both 17, who have driven to Boston from Washington, D.C.,
to attend this event.
What do you like about it?
It's a huge adrenaline rush.
That's what everybody says.
Yeah, and also, I love strategy, and there's a ton of strategy involved. There's a lot of finesse and technical abilities that you have to be able
like
to...
sliding on your face?
Yeah. Not, and it's one of those funny things that it looks like it's just totally, you know, out there and everything. It doesn't look like you have to have any skills at all. It just looks like you run out there and go, ah, you know, and shoot at people. But it really, there's a lot of, you know, little finesse that you have to have in the way you move in the bunkers and the way you shoot.
Collier and Doyle are here to watch their favorite players, including Oliver Lang, and to shop for paintball equipment. Devoted amateurs like these are constantly looking to upgrade their equipment. A gun, also called a marker, can cost as much as $1,200. Players tend to buy paintballs by the caseload at $60 a pop. Collier admits that it all adds up.
For me, it's paintball and car payments are about the same. So
do you spend, let's say, more money on this than... video games than anything else?
I don't play video games.
So, but you have to buy pads, you have to buy paint, the gun is $1,000?
They're real expensive. I don't shoot that expensive of a gun, but I'm looking to buy one, though.
The National Professional Paintball League sponsors 5 regional events each year called the Super 7 Series. The NPPL invites 200 teams of 7 players, mostly amateurs, to compete for cash prizes ranging from $1,000 to $25,000. But events are as much regional conventions as competitions. Each one draws more than 30,000 fans. Major manufacturers that set up shop outside the arenas expect to clear $80,000 to $120,000 in sales during the 3-day event. While the Miami Rage decimates the Stockholm Joy division, one woman sits in the stands reading a thick novel. She says her 15-year-old son is off cheering and spending money. Reluctantly, she admits that she's actually played paintball before.
Just in the woods with my son. He kind of got me into it, and I wouldn't tell him that often that it was fun because he's, like, always wanting to upgrade, and I didn't want him to, like, oh, boy, Mom, maybe you take my gun and I can get a new gun. But I really had a lot of fun with it.
In fact, she is so ashamed of having enjoyed it so much that she won't give her full name or her hometown. She's just Meredith from Massachusetts, and she is resisting the urge to play a real game of paintball.
You know, I didn't play a full game. I was just hitting trees. But my son has been after me to, come on, Mom, let's go out and play. And I'm saying, yeah, you'd probably, you know, cream me if I was out there.
And he'd like that.
He would. It would be a good way for him to get out his frustrations on me. But, no, I don't know. I just found it fun.
What Meredith doesn't understand is that everybody gets creamed playing paintball, or shot, or marked, or killed, or whatever you decide to call it. That's part of the fun, they say. In the early days of paintball, back in the 1980s, a player would shoot just a few dozen pellets per match, and the matches would go on for hours. Now, each player will shoot thousands of them in matches that rarely last more than 5 minutes.
Two in the stack! Two in the stack! One in the tower!
Between matches, workers shovel unexploded paintballs off the AstroTurf and cart them away in wheelbarrows. They sponge down the bunkers, which have names such as the Dorito, the Car Wash, or the Snake. As the playing field is cleaned up, players, including 56-year-old John Smith, walk the field and strategize.
Probably strategy, the opening strategy that you have is probably 50% of whether you're going to win or not. So it's actually, it's almost like a high-speed chess game. It really is. A lot of strategy to it.
But with guns.
But with guns, yeah, how can you beat that, right? Guns, and then when after you get hit, when it's all over, you're still alive.
Get him out! Get him out! Get him out! Hey, play it on!
If a player gets shot, he is supposed to stop firing and leave the field. If he doesn't, he is playing on, which is illegal. 42-year-old Jean Dupre of Team Recluse helpfully points this out to the referees minding his team's match. By the time the offending player does get ejected, Recluse has already lost. They have to win their next match against Team TPA in order to take third place in Division 3, which is the lowest level of national competitive play. A third place trophy comes with a $1,000 prize, which roughly covers the team's entry fee for this tournament. Normally, Dupre plays on the team alongside his son. In fact, he's wearing a team uniform and carries a spare gun with him. But for this series, he has decided to coach.
And I'm going to shut down the snake by getting Johnny to the 50. Johnny makes it live to 50, he'll shut down their snake.
Center 50?
Yeah, then I could have Brandon come up the Doritos.
Dupre is one of those parents who tagged along with his 14-year-old son to a paintball field and was instantly hooked. That was 2 years ago. Now it's all the Duprés do all weekend, every weekend.
Then I said, yeah, it's no fun just playing for fun. So I said, we need to get a team and do some competition. So, you know, we're right now, I believe after this tournament, we'll probably be inside the top five or six, Division III in the world.
Dupre has flown himself, his wife, his son, and six additional teammates to Boston from their home in Southern California. Team Recluse will be at all five NPPL events this season. Next season, they will qualify to play at the tougher Division II level. And yes, Dupre says, some of the kids are hoping to turn pro.
We're coached by two of the pro players from Team Dynasty, one of the best teams in the world. They got their eyes on my son and a couple of the boys, you know, so I had at least three or four boys on a team that'll definitely play pro if they want.
If it all works out, any one of the boys could be the next Oliver Lang, traveling to paintball tournaments, giving interviews, promoting the sport, improving its image, and learning about paintball's other competition, the one for sponsorships. Rocky Knuth, founder and captain of Team Naughty Dogs out of Portland, Oregon, knows the score. You don't win just to win, says Knuth. You win to promote yourself as a brand to companies with marketing money to spend. Some teams have dozens of these sponsorships. One, Team Dynasty, has an annual budget of more than $400,000 in sponsorships. Team Naughty Dogs would like to ascend to that class.
You have to wear certain things then?
Oh, yeah, totally.
What are you wearing today that has to be?
We're clothing sponsored. We're Empire. So we're an Empire team, so everything we have is Empire.
And then shoes and everything?
No, shoes, no, that's open.
Okay.
So if Nike, Adidas wants to come get us, naughtydogs.net.
For Only a Game, I'm Michelle Seaton in Foxborough, Massachusetts.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll free. CDs and cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to view David Summerstein's freestyle canoe photo gallery or a video of Jonathan Hammond performing the difficult and mesmerizing Hiding Harold move, please visit onlyagame.org, where you can also listen to stories past and present or sign up for our newsletter. Our final word comes from USA Today columnist Mike Lopresti, who recalls the story of a few Florida Marlins who, at a recent home game, effortlessly eavesdropped on the fans.
They heard very clearly one time when a couple of people got in an argument and one of the box eights. It was a non-baseball topic, as I understand.
Yeah, they may have been talking about the Miami Dolphins or the Kansas City Royals. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from WBUR Boston. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in children, their families, and their communities. On the web at WKKF.org. Anne and John Herman, supporting City Year and the young adults who dedicate a year of their lives to community service and leadership development. CityYear.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, with a new website at MacFound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.